Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
Part of my introduction to administrative law and regulatory agencies. And here I want to clarify the important concept of an enabling statute. And to do this, I want to tell you a story. When I was a law student, and for my Gen Z students, that was a long time ago, back in the 1900s, I did an internship at one point for the state attorney general's office in the state where I was living at the time. And the particular department that I worked in represented the Department of Corrections and the state police and so forth. And for one of my first assignments, I was called into a meeting of some government lawyers with the Commissioner of Corrections. Now, that's the person who oversees, the government official who is in charge of the Department of Corrections or the prison system for the state. So he sort of decides when to open and close prisons, managing prisons, hiring wardens and for prisons and so forth, and setting policies for the Department of Corrections. And he had an idea that the lawyers were discussing with him. You see, in this state at this time, the inmates prepared the food that the other prisoners ate. So different inmates were assigned to different chore details in the prison, and some were assigned to kitchen duty, to cooking. This was actually a desirable chore to get assigned to. It was better than being outside in the hot sun or rain. And you might actually acquire some skills that would help you get reintegrated into society after you completed your sentence. If you knew how to work in a commercial kitchen, you could get a job at a restaurant or a diner or a catering service or something like that. And so this prison system, the Department of Corrections, had actually opened a culinary institute or cooking school for prisoners, for inmates. And they, in a central location in the state, and they would bus the people who had been assigned to kitchen duty from the different prisons in the state to this place periodically to train them in cooking. Now, this cooking institute, so far so good, right, was located in one of these communities that was predominantly a retirement community, or had a lot of assisted living facilities and senior citizen communities and so forth, neighborhoods and developments and on and on. So for several miles in every direction from this particular piece of real estate, there were a lot of senior living centers and retirement communities. And the Commissioner of Corrections thought it would be a nice gesture to have the inmates make a spaghetti dinner and serve it maybe once a month and serve it to the seniors who lived in the vicinity. They could come there and get a free spaghetti dinner, and the inmates would serve them and see the senior citizens or retirees smiling in gratitude at them and so forth. Now, as a first-year law student, you can imagine the things that were racing through my mind. It was the things I had studied in my first-year law courses. I hadn't had administrative law. And so I was thinking of all the torts that could happen, right? Somebody could assault someone or poison someone or things like that. And also the issues with prisoners trying to escape problems with the food not getting delivered to the facility when on the day it was supposed to, all the things like that. And every time I started bringing one of those up, they would cut me off and say, we've already addressed that, right? We've already researched that. We've already decided how we're going to handle that. And my assignment was to determine from the statutes if the Commissioner of Corrections actually had statutory authority to do these spaghetti dinner programs and for the public. We're using the food that the inmates prepared. And so that's where we come back to the enabling statute. By the way, that's kind of the whole story, right? It's not going to be a best-selling novel anytime soon. But this was my personal introduction to administrative law, is I had to go find a statute. I didn't know what an enabling statute was. And that where the state legislature had created the Department of Corrections and had specified that there would be an official, the Commissioner of Corrections, who was over this department. And this statute, which was really only one or two paragraphs long, spelled out all the powers and duties and responsibilities of this official, of the commissioner. It was, a lot of it was the things that you would expect for someone who's managing the state's prison system, right? To carry out the penological or punishment goals of the criminal justice system, to protect the inmates, the safety of the inmates, and make sure that they were kept alive and didn't hurt each other or weren't injured and so forth, to protect the community, the safety of the community. There was a mention of running programs for rehabilitation of the incarcerated population and so forth. Nothing was there about spaghetti dinners. Unsurprisingly, the legislature didn't say in the enabling statute, which was about a paragraph or two, about all of the duties and responsibilities of the Commissioner of Corrections. They didn't say anything about serving spaghetti dinners to senior citizens. And so this is typical for an enabling statute. So just to give an idea, enabling statutes often are going to be rather succinct and have some broad policy goals that they set forth, some very specific responsibilities and duties and authorizations or in areas where the commissioner has discretion. And then it's usually pretty short on details. And so the question was, does the commissioner have statutory authority to do this? And if he doesn't, then he would be acting outside of his legal authority. In some other areas of law, we call this ultra vires, right? That's a Latin phrase for acting outside the scope of your legal authority. And the consequence of acting beyond your legal authority is that your actions have no legal force. They're legally void, right? So the Commissioner of Corrections in one state can't just announce what the prisons are going to do in another state. That's outside of his legal authority. Nor can he set standards for tailpipe emissions from automobiles, right? Or set fire codes for the state, because that's not his job. He has to act within his statutory authority. And so the enabling statute is very, very important in administrative law, and most of our cases are going to discuss it. And the enabling statutes have a lot of sort of broad language and are silent on a lot of issues. So we have a lot of issues with statutory interpretation and looking at the legislative history or whether we should do that. When do courts defer to the agency for filling in the gaps when there's statutory silence and so forth. But at the end of the day, anything that an administrator or government official does has to fit within the parameters set by the enabling statute. That's why we call it the enabling statute. And if they don't, they're not able to do that legally. Right. So for this assignment, I decided that the answer was probably, right? Probably this could be framed as serving the rehabilitation goals that are part of the enabling statute. And so, right, maybe it would be good for the inmates not only to acquire cooking skills, but to have very limited, monitored contact with the public on special occasions where they could engage in serving people and seeing the responses and kind of see someone outside of the prison for a change. And that might be helpful. But that also means that the commissioner might want to frame the program in terms of the language of the statute and what the statute allows, instead of just saying, I'm the commissioner of corrections, so I think I get to do this. This story, my spaghetti dinner story, was my introduction to administrative law, and it's a story I use in my classes and throughout our discussion to keep redirecting students back to the statute. In administrative law, procedure matters, but the statute also really matters. The statute is always paramount. Now, most of the time, they are going to be acting within the statute, and the statutes give a lot of leeway or latitude to government officials, especially the top officials in the agencies. But ultimately, it does set the outer boundaries of what any given agency and the top officials of that agency can do. And that concludes my little story about spaghetti dinners.
Next, we take a look back at the 1930s in America and the extraordinary story of how President Franklin Roosevelt accomplished the New Deal, his plan to end the economic damages of the Great Depression. That is the focus of the new book, Taming the Street, the Old Guard, the New Deal, and FDR's Fight to Regulate American Capitalism. Author and financial journalist Diana B. Enriquez joins colleagues Walter Isaacson to talk about the benefits that Americans still reap today because of the New Deal.
Thank you. And Diana Enriquez, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Walter.
This great book, Taming the Street, it's a wild ride about Franklin Roosevelt and his regulation of the securities industry. But one thing I liked was how you have to start with the Jazz Age. You have to start in the 1920s to get what it's all about. Tell me why 100 years ago we were laying the groundwork for what Franklin Roosevelt had to do.
Well, it's important to know that that was the world of Wall Street that Franklin Roosevelt and his New Deal allies grew up with. That's the world they knew, the world of the 1920s. And it was not a safe place for ordinary American investors. Stock market prices were routinely rigged. Bonds and stocks were sold with deceptive material, false promises. Banks failed with great regularity. And when they failed, you lost all your savings almost overnight. Mutual funds, mainstay of our current investment life, were basically private piggy banks for the brokerage firms that sponsor them. So that was the world that that FDR knew. Beyond the world of Wall Street, though, it was a world of almost seamless corruption, Walter.
You know, these respectable lawbreakers, as they seem to be in the book, the ones who were doing all that financial shenanigans, they seem to sort of be the close cousins, almost, the image of some of the rum runners and gangsters and scoundrels of the Jazz Age.
They did. In fact, it was some journalist wag who termed them banksters instead of gangsters. And that name, unfortunately, stuck.
How important was all of these shenanigans in causing the great crash of 1929?
The pundits of the day thought that the stock market crash would be a non-event for ordinary Americans because a very small percentage of them owned stocks. The stock market had become, in the Jazz Age, quite the popular game. I mean, it was covered in the newspapers and all the celebrities had their favorite stocks. But ordinary Americans were not deeply involved in terms of having their wealth at risk in the stock market. But what those pundits had not allowed for was the fear that would induce people to start tightening their belt from the very top level right on down. So as rich people stopped spending, they stopped hiring, maids. They stopped buying luxury products. They canceled the order on the new condo. They shrunk their spending, and that rippled down in a vicious circle down to the lowliest of Americans.
How much did Franklin Roosevelt's time as the governor of the state of New York help lay the groundwork for what he does with the New Deal?
Well, I lay out in Taming the Street some of his really instructive foxhole experiences as he was governor of New York. He presided over, in December of 1930, what was then the largest bank failure in U.S. history, the eighth largest bank in the country, a bank called the Bank of the United States in New York City, failed almost overnight, despite desperate efforts by Roosevelt's banking superintendent and his lieutenant governor, Herbert Lehman, to try to rescue the bank. And when it failed, the damage it did to small merchants all through the garment industry in New York City and beyond was devastating. And that experience was a shock. It was a wake-up call to FDR. Previous to that, he had presided over two other bank failures, much smaller, but he had kind of let the banking interests who controlled the legislature in Albany persuade him that bankers could regulate themselves. No great changes in laws were needed. And if he would just leave them alone, they'd work this out. So when the Bank of the United States failed, it was a splash of cold water in the face that showed him that, no, more was needed.
In 1932, he runs for president, touting his New Deal policies. It's after the stock market crash and after it's now ignited the what becomes the Great Depression. You write mainly about his regulation of the financial industry. How important was that type of promises to his 1932 campaign? Or did people quite get the need for financial regulation?
Well, I think, and my thesis in the book is that these financial reforms were the heart and soul of the New Deal as Roosevelt presented it in the campaign of 1932 and in 1936 as well, when he ran for re-election on the strength of what he'd done. And he laid out the specific financial reforms that he intended to implement. And, you know, there's a lot of conventional wisdom that no one really knew what he planned to do in the New Deal. He was kind of vague, and that really all he had to do was not be President Herbert Hoover and he would get elected. But the evidence from the newspaper coverage of his campaign just does not support that at all. He was explicit. He was going to regulate stock exchanges. He was going to improve the regulation of banks. He was going to make sure that securities were sold with honesty and truth, not with deception. He was going to make sure that giant holding companies couldn't stuff all sorts of overhead costs on the backs of their consumers. He was very explicit. So, you know, I think because of so much that happened in Roosevelt's career as president, one of the most eventful probably in this country's history, the role of financial reform in the very early days of his campaigning and of his presidency has been kind of obscured. And part of what I wanted to do with this book was correct that, to show how central financial reform was to Roosevelt's thinking. And for a very good reason, Walter, that's still relevant today. He was firmly convinced that a healthy democracy required a healthy economy.
One of the colorful characters in your book, of course, is Joseph Kennedy, the father of President Kennedy and Senator Kennedy, and sort of intertwines quite a bit with the life of Franklin Roosevelt. Tell me about that relationship and what Joseph Kennedy saw in Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, what a strange kind of relationship. There's nothing on the surface of it that made it look plausible. Joe Kennedy was a buccaneer. He was a swashbuckling speculator who was committing many of the crimes that Franklin Roosevelt later wanted to eliminate. But he saw in Roosevelt the man for a moment. And the moment that Joe Kennedy saw, and perhaps more clearly, because of the world he occupied, was an America that was just about to come apart. between the angry demands on the left, a rising interest in communism and socialism, and even scarier forces on the right, people who were looking at fascist authorities in Germany and in Italy and saying, maybe that's what we need right now, stamp out these labor unions, you know, get business in charge. And Kennedy saw all of that as adding up to a time of a perhaps terminal unrest in the United States. He felt it was essential that democracy show it could work in this moment. It could address this economic crisis. He said once, I decided in those days, I would give half of what I had to be able to enjoy the other half under law and order. He felt that the society was falling apart and that Roosevelt was the man who could fix it.
So Roosevelt, in his early, one of his early acts, creates a Security and Exchange Commission, a key thing in your book. And so then the SEC, to run it, he appoints Joe Kennedy. I mean, it's like Joe Kennedy was a stock speculator and all.
Right.
Wasn't that like putting the fox in charge of the hen house?
Washington exploded, Walter. I mean, it absolutely exploded. But there were some journalists who said, I don't believe it. I just don't believe that this rumor is true. But in fact, FDR was very, very savvy to name Joe Kennedy. First of all, Wall Street, which had fiercely fought not only this bill creating the SEC, but the early one that had required truth in the sales of securities. And, you know, they could hardly say, well, you know, this guy doesn't know anything about Wall Street. You know, you're putting an idiot in charge of our marketplace. No one knew Wall Street better than Joe Kennedy did. So FDR saw it as a way to disarm Wall Street's, you know, predictable objections. But he knew, as most of the American public did not, that Joe Kennedy had always been an outsider on the street. He played a lone game. He kept his cards very close to his chest. And he was no more beholden to those Wall Street titans than Roosevelt was.
So how well did he do?
It was a masterpiece of public service, Walter. It really was. And given the rest of Joe Kennedy's career, it seems odd to say that, but it really was. As I reviewed in great detail, the daily workings, the minutes of the meetings he ran, the appointments he made, the people he hired, it was truly a remarkable act of public service. He took a bunch of words on paper and in a few months turned them into a watchdog agency that was on the street, that was on the job right away.
Franklin Roosevelt has an incredibly active first 100 days, as it was called. Does all sorts of things to try to tackle the Great Depression. Tell me about some of the other things besides, in addition to financial regulation, and how those were connected to his Wall Street regulations.
Well, the one we know best, of course, is his banking reform, and I consider that as well part of his financial reforms. As you know, Walter, when Roosevelt was sworn in on March 4th in 1933, we were in the midst of the most serious banking crisis the country had ever experienced. Around 3 o'clock in the morning on the day Roosevelt was sworn in, New York became the final state to shut its banks. They were being shuttered across the country to protect them from panicky runs by their customers. And with the banks shut, particularly the money center banks, the stock exchange closed, the commodity exchanges closed. The financial machinery of the country had come to a dead standstill by dawn on Inauguration Day. So job one for Roosevelt was to get those banks open again. And the tale of how he did it, to me, is one of the best bits of the book. It was really remarkable. The lessons he brought from his governorship were brought to bear. He understood that the banks were in trouble, not because people didn't trust the New Deal. They were in trouble because people didn't trust the banks. And so his idea was to intervene a bank moratorium to give regulators in every state and in the Treasury Department time to assort which banks were strong, which were weak, which needed new capital, what could be done to rescue them. And then he had a fireside chat. The first of those radio addresses to the American public that became so famous was on the banking crisis. And he explained to them in just everyday kitchen table language how the banking system worked, how it had gotten in trouble, what he was doing to try to fix it, and what they should do when their banks reopened. And he assured them that any bank that reopened after this moratorium could be trusted. And so within 10 days, banks started to reopen. And in defiance of Herbert Hoover's predictions, people lined up to put money back in. So it was a remarkable display of how much an infusion of confidence could matter just as much as an infusion of capital.
One of the things I always said about Roosevelt is that his style was to just try anything, to keep trying, to make sure you were seen trying.
Yes.
That can lead to some missteps. What failures do you think happened in the New Deal?
Well, there were no doubt the National Recovery Act, which was struck down by the Supreme Court very early in the New Deal, I think was a wrong-headed idea. And the National Recovery Act was an effort to allow industry to work together, to coordinate together, supposedly to support prices and wages. What it was devolving into was, price fixing and wage suppression. And by the time the Supreme Court struck it down, the rest of the New Dealers had basically said, this is not working. We need something else. So that was a misstep. Perhaps his worst failings on the financial reform front, however, was his handling of the 1937 recession, which I deal with in the book. It's hard for someone I admire as much as Roosevelt for me to say he really flubbed it, but he really flubbed it. He was getting a lot of advice from more conservative New Dealers, Joe Kennedy among them, that he needed to balance the budget. Okay, we're out of the emergency. We've cured the depression. Things are on the rebound. Now we've got to get back to brass tacks, to the old hale and hearty truisms of a balanced budget. So he cut spending in 1936 and then going into 37, long before the economy was ready to absorb that kind of cut.
You say it's so urgent that we understand this today when we're having a crisis of democracy and sometimes a crisis of confidence when it comes to the financial sector. Explain why you think this is urgent now.
Well, in a very real sense, Walter, these reforms that we've inherited from FDR, which we take so much for granted today, they're on the ballot in 2024. One of the major candidates likely to be running for president has an open track record of hostility to financial regulation. President Trump bragged in his 2018 State of the Union that he'd done more than any administration in history to reduce financial regulation. And that's not just Trump hyperbole. He did. And he will again. His track record was to put appointees in charge of regulatory agencies who were openly hostile to the mission of those agencies. He appointed pro-business anti-regulatory judges every time he could. So another Trump term would mean further destruction of the financial regulatory machine that served us pretty darn well for nearly 90 years.
But aren't there some regulations that you think need to be revisited?
Oh, absolutely. And more than revisited. Another way that financial reform is on the ballot in 2024 is we've got to elect people to Congress and the Senate who can get to work wisely and quickly modernizing the financial regulatory system that's grown up around the core of Roosevelt's reforms and prepare it for a new century. So we've got to have people who are committed to financial protection, to investor protection, but who are going to work together to produce with industry a modernized financial reform that can continue Roosevelt's work. To have a Congress full of people ready to tear all this stuff down would be disastrous, because we've got our 401k plans, our pensions are tied up in the stock market, our mortgages are important to our financial security. Americans today are so much more engaged with the world of finance that they would be so much more at risk if the rules of that world devolved back to what they had been in the Jazz Age.
Class war, class war, class war.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am your brother, Vladimir Dietz. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode segment. Yeah, because it's kind of part, it is part two to the episode that I produced reading this National Affairs article, Designing a Better Regulatory State. I skipped over some parts that I'm going to do my best to get through and comment on today with you. And I am hopeful that those of you who listen to this will understand, look, this, rarely do people who consider themselves progressives or on the left take on the challenge of commenting on these type of think pieces that are very important to the intellectual psychology of conservatives. Most ordinary people who count themselves as conservatives will never read what I'm reading here. Most ordinary conservatives don't subscribe to National Affairs or to any major political national magazine. They wouldn't know, most of them would not know the first thing about reading through these articles, deducing them, digesting them, ingesting them, and understanding in many instances what is being said and what isn't being said. Many of them would take what I'm saying, by the way, and be like, what, you're telling me I'm stupid or something? First, I would say, don't use a word that you don't know what it means, because I'm not saying that you're stupid. I'm not saying that you're unintelligent. I'm not making a statement on your intelligence at all. I'm just stating facts. Most ordinary, no-collar conservatives, including many Christian conservatives, they wouldn't read this. Not because they couldn't, some of them couldn't, but because they'd find it uninteresting. They would say, well, what does this have to really do with conservatism? This forms your conservatism. This is the underpinning of your conservatism. Many of you have not read the think piece articles that really go towards constructing what you call conservatism. That's why I'm doing this. I'm also doing it for the left. because many of them ain't touching this stuff either, and I wish they would. So, one of the sections that I skipped is titled, Why We Need a Regulatory State. Conservatives, I was thinking about rereading the introduction to this, because the introduction has a lot in it, but if I reread the introduction, then I'm going to end up stopping a lot in the first 20 minutes. It's just going to be me rehashing things that I already said. So, let's go to Why We Need a Regulatory State. Conservatives are reluctant to concede that there is anything fundamental right with the regulatory state. In their view, it was a mistake to permit executive agencies to develop and coalesce into a fourth branch of government. He puts fourth branch in quotes. Some even go so far as to describe the regulatory state as an alien tyranny foisted by arrogant progressives on an unwitting public. Now, mind you, I guarantee you some of this he was saying back in the 80s, back in the 90s, because this man has been around since before probably the Reagan Revolution, but I bet you he cut his teeth during the Reagan Revolution. So he knows about this stuff. One of the things that I love about conservatives, they're really good at doing this, is they'll take mistakes that they now perceive themselves as making in the past, statements that they themselves promulgated, and then they'll be like, yo, some people said, and it's like, yeah, who these some people, man? Oh, these some people were you. Why don't you just say, I previously thought, and this is why I'm wrong. One of the things that faux leftist, centrist leading right-wing progressives have recently begun doing was citing something that I cited years ago was narcissism within the left. And within the narcissistic complex, whether you're talking about left-wing narcissism or right-wing narcissism, because both sides have it, they just manifest it differently. This notion of not apologizing for when you are wrong is big. And I got to tell you, the left-wing narcissism really shows up more in liberalism than it does in actual leftists. Not to say that it can't show up in actual leftists, it just shows up a lot more in liberals than it does in actual leftists. Continuing. While the conservative critique of the regulatory state is not unfounded, man, oh, this is going to be difficult. From a historical perspective, while the conservative critique of the regulatory state is not unfounded, let me back up and tell you what this critique is. Some even go as far, okay, so let me back up to the first paragraph. Conservatives are reluctant to concede that there is anything fundamentally right with the regulatory state. In their view, it was a mistake to permit executive agencies to develop and coalesce into a, quote, fourth branch of government. Some even go so far as to describe the regulatory state as an alien tyranny foisted by arrogant progressives on an unwitting public. While the conservative critique of the regulatory state is not unfounded, the two items that he mentions, in their view, conservatives, it was a mistake to permit executive agencies to develop and coalesce into a fourth branch of government. The reason this happened, and you'll see in a moment where he goes with this, but the reason this occurred was because when there was not significant regulation of capital, and of corporations, and of monopolies, the disasters that resulted were not only terrible for humans, they were terrible for the environment. The, quote, fourth branch was created by necessity. Because while all these libertarian conservatives like to talk trash about, oh, just let corporations be and they'll regulate themselves, that's never been the case. Cancer does not regulate itself. It doesn't understand how to regulate itself. And even if you don't look at corporations as I do, as cancer, the history, specifically the post-Civil War, American Civil War history of corporations in the United States, tells you all you need to know about trusting corporations to regulate themselves. The fourth branch, which has always semi-been there, even if it's not counted as being there, there's always been some sort of bureaucracy. Was pushed into creation by the actions, the destructive actions of capitalism. And the idea, some even go as far as to describe the regulatory state as an alien tyranny foisted by... Who would say that? What, corporations? They don't get a vote on this one. They get a vote on everything else, but they don't get to talk about what tyranny is. Because if you look at where the United States was, particularly for average workers in the late 1800s to early 1900s, before all this, quote, state tyranny appeared, when people were literally working 12 to 16-hour days for pennies every hour. Pennies! You could work a full week and owe your company money because of company stores and other things that they use to trick you out of your money. So the people who want to call regulatory agencies tyrants have no stool, no box, no nothing to stand on. And for him to then come out and say, well, the conservative critique of the regulatory state is not unfounded. Okay, let's move on, because it's already 11 minutes. I ain't even through this section yet. Let's go. While the conservative critique of the regulatory state is not unfounded, from a historical perspective, the rise of regulation and the attendant rise in the need for institutions to develop, adopt, and enforce new rules was a necessary response to the dramatic changes that took place in our society after the founding. This guy right here. Continuing. Such changes led to an increase in the complexity of daily life and in turn a rise in the complexity of the challenges facing our governing institutions. This guy right here. Most of the modern regulatory, quote, tyranny that he referenced in that first paragraph that I read had nothing to do with the complexity of life. It had to do with the tyranny of corporations. This guy right here. Let's continue. From historical forces in particular, historical forces in particular, help explain why the challenges of governance are more complicated in the 20s. This guy right here. I almost don't want to read the rest of this. It is so fanciful. I mean, honest to God, he completely skips over the fact that it was the tyranny of the corporations, the fact that corporations were putting out products that literally were built to get you addicted. They put in illicit drugs and stuff to get you addicted. Stuff that could kill you because they didn't care. They were just trying to make money. And that was the beginning of the regulatory buildup in the United States. Late 1800s, early 1900s. The New Deal regulatory push was actually a second or a third phase, depending on how you want to, you know, count things. But I count it as the second great phase. But it had nothing to do with the complexity. It had to do with the fact that corporations were not acting right. This guy right here. Continuing. Four historical forces in particular help explain why the challenges of governance are more complicated in the 21st century than they are when the Constitution was written. Greater urbanization, the rising importance of intangible sources of wealth, increased specialization in the digital revolution. So here's why I'm so frustrated by this, ladies and gentlemen, is because if you're going to start off a section with conservatives are reluctant to concede that there is anything fundamentally right with the regulatory state. In their view, it was a mistake to permit executive agencies to develop and coalesce into a fourth branch of government. You have to do work. To either prove or disprove that statement. You are making a historical claim at the outset of this entire paragraph, and then you shift abruptly to, oh yeah, but we're only going to focus on the things that are impacting the 21st century. Wait, what? And then you follow up that sentence with, some even go so far as to describe the regulatory state as an alien tyranny foisted by arrogant progressives on an unwitting public. Now, for the untrained ear, what you hear is a modern argument. What you hear is a modern argument, but here's where he's playing with your mind. You think when he says progressives, he's talking about today. He is not historically talking about progressives today. The progressives haven't been technically around long enough to foist any regulatory agency onto you. And despite what many of you may think, Barack Obama don't count. He's a moderate. The guy literally praised Reagan. Now, the progressives he is actually talking about, who foisted their arrogant alien tyranny known as the regulatory state onto the capitalists, ladies and gentlemen, he's talking about the early 1900s. I'm not saying the 1950s, the 1970s, the 1990s. This man is talking literally about the first couple of decades, and particularly the first decade and a half of the 1900s. Those are the progressives he's talking about, and he knows those are the progressives he's talking about. He's telling you historically that all of that was built up from 1900 to about 1915 was wrong. And then he proceeds to pivot away from that, never proving what he's saying, never contextualizing what he has said, and then tries to pull you further into the present with this idea of, oh yeah, but there is four major things that have... The four things he mentions, which is greater urbanization. What? Okay, I get it. You're talking about suburban life. That did take some special regulation, but most of the regulation in the second aspect of Creation of the regulatory state did not take place because of freaking urbanization. It took place because, one, of the New Deal. And yes, while they were planning for a post-war urbanization boom, those are called suburbs, by the way, those regulations were less for corporations and more for residential places to make them more livable and inhabitable. So those clearly are not as important. And when they're talking about regulatory state, they're not talking about the stuff that's making your life better on a residential standpoint. They're talking about regulatory or regulations that either allow them to or prevent them from conducting business in the way that they want. The second one, the rising importance of intangible sources of wealth. What? The intangible source of wealth did indeed increase throughout the 1900s, and indeed some regulation was built surrounding that. But again, he is misleading you, because it wasn't about the importance of intangible sources of wealth that all the regulations came about. It was because the government wanted to prevent corporations from doing as they had done previously, which was put shoddy things out that were destructive, that were injurious, and that ultimately were only put out because it allowed them to make money. It wasn't because of the importance of intangible sources of wealth. Nor was it about increased specialization and the digital revolution. There has been so little regulation put out to actually manage this digital revolution that it isn't fair for the average small worker or business that wants to actually participate in the digital revolution, who isn't actually part of one of the larger digital institutions or one of the financing institutions that finance the digital institutions. So, I mean, it's, like I said, it's hard for me to even continue reading this slop, because that's what it, this is terrible. He starts off making an assertion, and he doesn't even go through and follow through with proving that assertion. He makes another assertion that not only isn't rooted in the truth of why the regulatory state occurred and why it was built up, but obscures it by trying to make it more contemporary, when it isn't. It isn't. But I'm going to choke through this. Let's see if we can get through this. First, greater urbanization has meant that people increasingly live in a setting where what one person does with his property affects his neighbor and his neighbor's property. What is this guy talking about? Continuing. In a city, it matters whether the owner of the lot next door puts up a family residence, a psychiatrist's office, a 24-hour convenience store, or a nightclub. This is less true of rural area, where people's property is far more spread out. Although many of the issues posed by urbanization can be settled by individuals acting privately, life in the city creates various interpersonal conflicts that require more formal solutions. So I finally get what he's doing here. Even though most ordinary people will never read this article, what he's doing is he's telling people who will be on radios and television shows and what have you, he's giving them talking points on how to craft the argument for regulation. And this, he's posing that regulation was created for those people living in the urban centers. Well, who are those people who are living in the urban centers? Those people are black people and leftists. Black people and leftists. Brown people and leftists. That's what he's doing here. It's disingenuous. It's bull, but that's what he's doing here. Continuing. A rural household may be able to keep its pets to itself, but in the city, we all inevitably encounter our neighbor's pets. For everybody to get along, there has to be rules that all pet owners abide by, as well as an entity to issue and hold everyone to those rules. This isn't regulation. I mean, it's regulation at a city level and at a town level and at a community level, but that is not the regulatory state. That's not even close to the regulatory state. But, okay, let's keep going. In addition, some aspects of the urban landscape extend beyond the boundaries of particular cities. Transportation, energy, communications, and water treatment infrastructure are all examples of modern amenities that spread past the confines of urban locales. Yes, that is true. What he does not tell you is that if it was left up to corporations, they wouldn't do that. One of the things that came mostly in the post New Deal world was the expansion of transportation to more rural places, was the expansion of such things as electricity to more rural places. Why? Because the government was subsidizing it. It was giving tax breaks to allow it to happen. Why were they doing that? Because left by themselves, corporations said, it ain't worth it. We don't need to give these hicks out here. And by the way, most of them hicks was white. We don't need to give them hicks out there. None of this good stuff. None of this transportation. None of this electricity. None of these amenities that he's mentioning. The regulatory state made it possible to make these things available to a lot of people who probably still today wouldn't have access to them. But he ain't going to mention that. Continuing. When more wealth is tangible, I got to go up here. Such structures create externalities, both positive and negative, that cannot be confined to a single jurisdiction, calling for regulations and enforcement mechanisms that transcend jurisdictional boundaries. Probably should read that again. Such structures create externalities, both positive and negatives, that cannot be confined to a single jurisdiction, calling for regulations and enforcement mechanisms that transcend jurisdictional boundaries. I just cannot believe he does not acknowledge that without the previous statutes being rewritten nationally by the regulatory state, all these great things that he's speaking of, yeah, probably wouldn't exist. But continuing, at the same time, the rise in intangible sources of wealth since the founding has made property rights more complex. The classical liberal ideal of a minimal state is one in which the government serves only to define and protect these rights. I love how he keeps putting this on classical liberal thinking. When most wealth is tangible in form, such a government can have a small footprint. But when more sources of wealth are intangible, defining and enforcing property rights becomes far more challenging. Now, what he's talking about here with the intangible is your financial instruments, is your IPs. That's what he's talking about. He's not talking about anything that most of you are going to have any dealings with. Most of you average people ain't going to be dealing with these, quote, intangible sources of wealth. He is right, though. Those things would increase regulations. But They had speculators back in the day. And they had technically intangible wealth products. They just weren't as easily produced as they are today. And they would deal with you if you were doing inscrupulous or unscrupulous things with those intangible products. And when I say deal with you, they would either kick you out the country, kick you out the state, kick you out the area, or they'll just kick you out of life. Western justice on you. Continuing, to see why, imagine a Pennsylvania farmer. I love these guys. I love when they do this. It's always somebody like a farmer or something that they go to see why. Imagine a farmer or an island or continuing. To see why, imagine a Pennsylvania farmer in the year 1800. This farmer might go many months or even his entire life without encountering ambiguity in property rights. He knows that he owns his land, his tools, which, by the way, when he's talking about property rights, he is talking about IP right now. He knows that he owns his land, his tools, his farm animals, and whatever goods he produces, uses those resources. He can build whatever he would like on his property. He knows that what he sees in the store in town does not belong to him, but that he can make it his by purchasing it, and what he buys in the store, he can later sell if he no longer wishes to use it. What is amazing is this is just the most beautiful thing that neoconservatives do. They paint this ideal picture of what America used to be like. But this was never just what America used to be like. Because not everybody owned their farms. And most of them could have their farms taken away by banks. And most towns were founded on either captured land, especially in 1800, or by speculative land. Continuing. Compare yourself to this farmer. Every time you look at a smartphone, you are seeing ambiguity in terms of property rights. IP, y'all. Who owns the data about which websites you visit? Who owns your email? Who owns information about your location? You may have paid for the apps on the phone, but what rights does that give you? If you no longer wish to use those apps, you delete them. You cannot sell them to anyone. Determining the ownership of a piece of tangible property, such as a cornfield or a tractor, is relatively straightforward, but determining ownership of intangible property such as data or distinctive design is more complicated. Now, here's what's funny is, it didn't even enter my mind that when he was talking about intangibles, that he also was talking data and stuff like that. I consider data as part of IP. I think from a legal standpoint, they don't. But here's the thing. It is not more complicated. Corporations are making it more complicated so they can take advantage of it. So that they can capture more of it. Your data is your data. But they don't want you thinking that. They don't want you thinking that you own the information that you put out. Now, corporations, on the other hand, if they put out information, they own it. But if you as an individual put out information about yourself, you can't own that because, hey, we don't want you to. That's too much power in your hands, consumer. Yeah, you're not a citizen, guys. You're a consumer. Remember that. Now, for those of you who get angry about, oh, I'm a citizen, these corporations don't treat you like a citizen, because if you were a citizen, what you did would matter. You wouldn't be arguing for your own, quote, data rights. Just like a corporation doesn't argue for their data rights. A corporation is more of a citizen in this country than you are. Continuing. This creates governance challenges that call for greater expertise in regulation. I like the fact that he actually acknowledges this. Now, I wonder if he's one of these people who were actually advocating the exact opposite 22, 23, 24, 25 years ago. Because there were those who said, don't regulate the internet. Don't regulate the industries that put forward the internet, that, you know, control the internet, none of that. Don't regulate any of them. And I wonder if this was one of them, if this was one of those people saying that. Continuing. Enforcing property rights also comes more easily in an economy when tangible property is the primary source of wealth. If you want to use my land or machines without my permission, you have to use physical force of some kind to do so. And to protect my property rights, the government simply has to interfere with this forceful action. But in an economy where such intangible things as ideas, brand reputation, and management practices are major sources of wealth, protecting ownership is more complex. No force is required for you to use my ideas without my permission, and stopping you from doing so requires officials to conduct a more searching analysis beforehand. To protect my intangible property, the government must undertake considerable effort to verify my ownership and define my rights. It then must work to discover and punish violators and arrange for me to receive compensation. Here's the funny thing. Europe does this. It ain't that complex. Europe does this. It only gets complex when corporations want to figure out how to skirt the law. Continuing, while the same tasks were required when tangible property was the primary source of wealth, they were often far easier and required far less expertise to carry out. Additionally, unlike tangible property, intangible property is not scarce. With the internet, the same music, videos, news, updates, and ideas can be shared by everyone. What is scarce is the creativity and effort used to develop, create, and redefine such or refine such content. This requires government to resolve more and more ambiguous types of property disputes than it did 250 years ago, and to do so effectively, it must deploy greater expertise. So, here's the funny thing. So this is again, Europe does this. I'm floored. Europe does this. It's not that complex. If the United States really wanted to, it could just copy what Europe's doing. But so the regulatory stuff that he's talking about isn't the regulatory stuff that I'm talking about. And I knew this already. But it must be understood. If the type of regulations that were put into place between 1900, 1915, a little bit after there too, and 1930, 1955, were kept in place, a lot of this idea between ownership, or the confusion that he says between ownership of personal data and things like that, it would be cleared up, because back then, people started making distinctions between what is yours and mine. And in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, the Consumer Bill of Rights, things like that, a significant Consumer Bill of Rights would make all of this clear. But that's why a lot of corporations are against a Consumer Bill of Rights, because they don't want it clear. They want to be able to do with your information as they want. But don't you do with their information what you want, because you would be in violation of all kinds of statutes, but they won't. Continuing, production of tangible property itself is now much more specialized and roundabout than it was in 1800s, creating further complications. And I get off his train here, I will tell you that. But then the typical household was much closer to being self-sufficient than it is today. A farm family at the time was producing most of what it consumed. It certainly wasn't buying prepared foods, eating out at restaurants, hiring plumbers or electricians, or paying for entertainment. Most of the goods and services we consume today, by contrast, are the result of many intermediate activities performed by millions of strangers. This is largely because their production requires greater know-how in engineering, material science, finance, and management than it took to create the goods and services of the past. Now, again, he's going 250 years ago because if he goes back 125 years ago, then he has to worry about the conditions that were created by the capitalists at the time, which made necessary the progressive tyranny, quote-unquote, that he mentioned at the beginning of this section. So instead of doing that, he goes all the way back to 250 years ago. Instead of just tackling the fact that everything he's mentioning here, while true, only occurred because the shift towards consumption was so great during the New Deal process of equalizing the society. And then the programs that followed the decades after it, and I'm talking the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, that the standard of living rose so much that the consumer wanted more. The consumer wanted more. They required more. They needed more. And it was all because of what the New Deal put into place. The regulatory state that hyped up the economy during the New Deal and in the decade or two after it. That's what made everything that he just listed possible. And it was the regulations that were put on to ensure that those products, those needs, those wants were safe within the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. That made life better and worth living. But again, he has to go all the way back to 250 because 125 years ago revealed some truths that he don't want to have to deal with. Continuing.
This is largely because their production requires greater know-how in engineering, material science, finance, and management than it took to create the goods and services of the past. Promulgating, interpreting, and enforcing laws governing such activity cannot be undertaken by generic elected officials and judges on their own. Subject matter expertise must be brought to bear. And I bet you this is one of them guys who was yelling about the evils of bureaucrats back in the 80s and the 90s. We hate the bureaucrats. What he just was speaking of, the whole expertise thing, those are bureaucrats. Continuing. Increase interdependence brought on by the rise in specialization, also means increased sources of friction. Modern production and commerce require orders of magnitude more transactions than were conducted 250 years ago to provide the goods and services of that era. And if Reagan and Clinton and Bush did not tear apart the New Deal Depression era regulation regulating these financial institutions so that they could only perform one or two tasks. One, you'd have greater competition amongst financial institutions. You would have more spread out financial institutions. And two, I suspect all of these little cuts that they get you with, where you're paying $3 here for this, $3 for all service charges, would dissipate overnight. Continuing. A greater number of transactions lead to greater potential for disputes to arise, as well as more ambiguity over who is ultimately responsible for the products, quality, and performance. This, in turn, heightens the need for experts to weigh in and for officials to codify and enforce rules. Now, that is not for the average person, I think. That's more for the business and the financiers, that statement there. Continuing. to see why, suppose you make a medication that causes a harmful side effect. Who should be held responsible for the failure? Now, here's what's funny. I'm glad he brought that up. But again, if this is why it's hilarious that he doesn't go back 125 years. The literal reason why the FDA was brought into existence was because corporations were doing such dastardly things with items that they said were medications that the government was like, yeah, we're going to have to get involved. And in fact, it was grassroots people who said, you need to get involved in regulating these things because they're not safe. So it's funny that that's the first thing he brings up. To see why, suppose we take a medication that causes a harmful side effect. Who should be held responsible for the failure? How about the corporation who developed it? Continuing, perhaps the manufacturer was at fault for allowing an impurity into the pill. Let's be frank about this, man. How often does that happen? I have worked in many production warehouse sites. It is seldom, because of the number of checks that you have in those production areas, that major contaminations happen. Do they happen periodically? Absolutely. It's a big country. But the reason you don't see it happen a lot is because of regulations. Regulations aren't meant to catch everything because society's imperfect. But regulations are meant to, especially when you're talking about production, cut down on the possibility of contamination, widespread contamination from happening at such a level that it's near certain that it will almost always not happen. It typically is when people don't follow those regulations that the contamination happens. Continuing, perhaps the manufacturer was at fault for allowing an impurity into the pill, and I just have to say this also. It's funny that he starts with the lowest level, the manufacturer, which is the people who are actually producing the pill, people who are typically what we call no-collar people. It's funny that he starts there. Continuing. Or perhaps the inventor was at fault for not testing it sufficiently or providing a proper warning. Now, here's what's funny. If we take the current opioid crisis, for an example, and run it through his little experiment here. It wasn't the manufacturer. It wasn't the people at the bottom who made a mistake. The, quote, inventor, that's a corporation, knew the problems, didn't care about the problems because the upside via the profit was so large that it was like, yeah, who cares? Let's keep moving. But, you know, he brings in the next level right now. Continuing, perhaps the doctor was at fault for overlooking known drug interactions, or the pharmacist was at fault for failing to tell you how to use the medication. Again, instead of saying corporation, he says inventor. But he has no problem calling out the manufacturer. He has no problem calling out the pharmacist, low-level person, or the doctor, a little bit higher level. But these are all persons. The manufacturer is obviously corporation. But he doesn't, and the inventor is a corporation, but he doesn't say pharmaceutical company. He can't, because capitalism must be protected. Continuing, or perhaps you heard me, you are the one at fault for misusing the medication. Since the responsibility for a product's quality and performance is more diffuse in a more specialized economy, a third party must often step in to determine who is culpable for any given failure and to hold that person or entity responsible. By the way, we have that. It's called the Food and Drug Administration. Stop trying to defund it. All of you who hate defunding the police, you ain't got no problem with defunding government. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Defunding non-militarized government or non-quote intelligence government. Yeah, you'll give $1.5 trillion to that all day, but domestic stuff that is needed, man, you want to defund that every day. Oh, these guys, man. Continuing, to be sure, most transactions involved in the production and sale of goods are regulated effectively by private contracts and business norms. Underwriters Laboratories, to take one example, is a private institution that formulates standards to promote the safe use of technologies. This guy right here. Keep going. But some transactions are made safer and more efficient by government regulation. So, there are many institutions, many or associations and what have you that set standards for corporations. And over the last 40 years, what we have seen with these organizations and these associations and such is that the standards that they set aren't good for the average person. They're good for the corporations. Underwriters Laboratories may be a good organization. What did they do in regulating the pharmaceutical company that distributed the narcotics that blew up the opioid crisis? What'd they do? Oh, well, it's not our job to really, you know, we just set the standards. We don't really, like, enforce them or anything like that. That's the government's job. Okay, so now the entity that pays you your money, or the entities that pay you your money, how much money have they been paying to defund the regulatory state over the last 30 plus years? Well, we don't have anything to really say about that because, you know, and we're just here trying to do our job, and that's all we can really do. Of course! Of course. Why are you getting upset about this? I'm getting upset about it because if you're going to put yourself out as a watchdog in one of the worst opioid crises to occur in the United States in the last 100 years occurs while you are watching, I don't think you can call yourself that well of a watchdog. And if you continue to call yourself a watchdog, maybe we need to have that type of Old Yeller conversation that book has. Continuing, the Uniform Commercial Code, a uniformly adopted state law that governs commerce, offers a good example of how state-driven regulation can help facilitate the myriad transactions that must take place in order for the 21st century economy to operate. The digital revolution has only accelerated modernization. It has increased urbanization, at least thus far. It has increased the variety of importance of intangible asset. It has fostered even more specialization and a greater division of labor, and it has added to the importance of subject matter expertise. I am going, I might be able to get through all this. Okay. The internet facilitates the conduct of transactions regardless of whether they are legal, the sending of messages regardless of whether they are offensive, and the implementation of financial innovations regardless of whether they are safe. There is no sign that controversies in these realms will dissipate or be resolved by themselves. Moreover, the low cost of sending digital information around the world has made it possible for firms to achieve unprecedented scale. these firms are undertaking a kind of regulation of their own. Oh, hell no. Regardless of whether anyone cares to admit it, whether a social media powerhouse censors a political leader or vice versa, regulation is taking place and its impact is broadly felt. Here's the thing. When these people are talking about regulation, let's be very clear. They only bring it into the realm of free speech and things like that to try to personalize the corporate entity, to try to make people feel like they are connected to the corporate entity, when in fact, no. That is not what regulation was intended for. Regulation was meant to restrain the excesses of corporate power. The damaging portions of corporate power. The things that corporations have proven over and over and over again, whether we're talking domestically or internationally, that they refuse to curb themselves. That is what regulation was meant to do. People were not talking about the regulation of human speech. They weren't talking about the regulation of human action outside of the corporations. They were talking about regulating corporations because they were back then, 125 years ago, as they are today, and as he even points out, massively influential. And that massive influence was often utilized to the detriment of the average citizen in this country or the citizen elsewhere. So he's making a false equivalency here, and I'm not standing for it. The digital revolution has blurred the line between private-driven and public-driven regulation. If government officials ask a large technology company not to allow certain opinions to be aired, whoa. This man went somewhere complete, like, whoa. The only people right now who are threatening to really do that are right-wingers. Not left-wingers, right-wingers. That's where the threat is. And before you think that it's just a Donald Trump thing, remember, back in Bush's era, if you said anything negative about Bush, I mean, they were literally asking libraries to watch people and report if they thought somebody was taking out the wrong books. Remember that? If government officials ask a large technology company not to allow certain opinions to be aired on its platform, the state is not directly censoring speech. Wait, what? If the government official asks a large technology company not to allow certain opinions to be aired on its platform, the state is not directly censoring speech. And yet, by using a private company as a cat's paw for its aims, it is arguably engaging in censorship. This man is being completely disingenuous here, because Bush did this exact thing. And it was considered state censorship. He's being disingenuous. Bush did this exact same thing, and people called it for what it was back then. This was state censorship. Continuing. Thanks to these and related transformations, America in the 21st century needs more governance, and that governance requires more expertise than was required 250 years ago. If he would only go 125 years ago. Rather than denying this truth, conservatives could do better to accept it and begin thinking about ways to improve how the regulatory state functions. The fear that I have is that they'll take him up on his offer, because conservatives have no interest in making a regulatory state function better. They want to destroy it. They are nihilists. So, there is more to this. I don't know if I'm going to record this portion of it. Because there is quite a bit more. I may just make this a series and go through and do this whole thing. But if you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. Let me know also, guys, because look, if you think this is a waste of my time and a waste of your time, I won't do this much. But if you like this, me reading these long pieces to you and then commenting on them, let me know. Let me know. Because I kind of find it fun. I was looking at a book earlier that I might do some of this with. Two books, actually. Tucker Carlson's book. I might do this like a couple of chapters out of here. Ship of Fools. And then there's this other one that I won't tell you the name of it until I really decide if I'm going to do it, because it's quite amazing. So, again, questions, comments, concerns, you know, you can always reach out to me. I am your brother, Vimer Dees. Oh, guy, yeah. Big up to Dr. Oba. Bika, bika, Tishaka. If you don't know who he is, you know, check out his YouTube channel. But I'm going to let you know this. Pro-black all day, every day. That's who he is. And he comes from that standpoint. So, you know, if you can't handle that, you don't want to go in that kitchen. You heard? Questions, comments, concerns, reach out to me. I'm your brother, Vimer Dees Ogaya. Until the next one, y'all. Peace. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the gun to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.